Welcome to the IT Babble podcast, where we talk about educational technology and a whole lot more. You can find our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe, or your very favorite podcasting app. Also, you can find our blog at www.itbabble.com. Welcome back, everybody. It is the IT Babble podcast, episode 153. And man, we have got a great show for you. We're going to talk about Apple's MacBook Pro and some of its woes. I'm going to talk about my five-part series about Google Forms and Sheets. I saw this post on how to increase pay, no more summers off, by Ronnie Burt from The EduVlogger. We'll talk about that because that's hot news right now in America. We'll talk about, if we have time, we'll talk about gadgets that we IT people like to stick with, and why, if it works, if it's not broken, don't fix it, kind of a mentality sometimes we have. But first, Tony, let's start off with your big news. You were in the hospital, or in hospital, as the British say.
Yeah, in hospital, as the British say. In Seoul, I had to have a little part of my meniscus removed. I'm still in Seoul. I'm out of the hospital, but I'm in a hotel for about 48 hours because the hotel is actually next to the airport. It's very nice. It's more comfortable than the hospital, and it is cheaper than the private room I had. So,
so Korean healthcare, is it okay? I mean, if you happen to be traveling abroad and you break a leg,
I don't have national healthcare. I have private healthcare. Korean national healthcare, though, from people I know who have it, is actually pretty good. You pay for it. It's not free. It's just affordable. So it's just affordable healthcare. You sign up for it, and then you pay when you use it at the hospital, if that makes sense. You got to register, but you pay when you go to the hospital. And if you have a job, there's a withholding tax for your healthcare. Or some kind of like fixed payment. It's not very much, though, from what I understand. I think it might be like Japan, where they base it on your income from the year before, which I always thought was like super fair. Because if you lose your job, you still have if you lose your job, you can tell them that you lost your job and you don't have to pay for healthcare. But then when you find a job, you also don't have to pay for healthcare because you were unemployed for a percentage of time, and they factor those unemployment times in as a zero. So your average income is low or zero. Because you know what happens if you don't have a job, even if your healthcare is free. Once you find a job, if you have to start paying for everything immediately, you can't afford it.
Yeah.
So I always thought that was like a really, really good system. Anyway, the hospital was like super clean and staff were nice. They have these stupid pajamas they want patients to wear, and I literally refused to wear them. They didn't fit well, and I brought my own clothes for being in my room. And I told them if I had a procedure or something, I would put on the gown, but these are just pajamas. They're not for procedures.
Yeah.
So I refused to wear them. It was a little bit of a battle, but then finally they just let me go. And I figured out, I think, why. So this hospital is huge. I would estimate it. It's one of the top – I think it's one of the top like research medical hospitals in the world. It's Severance Hospital. They're leading the world in that Da Vinci robotic surgery.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I've heard a little bit about that.
They're training doctors on that, and they have an entire wing for robotic surgery. So anyway, and they have a cancer center that's bigger than the main building. It's huge, and a medical school. So I would say it's about – somewhere between 5 to 10 city blocks of space. It's huge.
Jeez, that is enormous.
And probably about 17 to 20 stories on a couple of the major buildings, and they all have multiple towers. So this complex has like 10, 15 restaurants in it, convenience stores. It has everything. Like, you can live in this hospital because Koreans, what they do is when you go to the hospital, you bring a family member with you and they sleep in the room with you. And if it's like a kind of cheaper, more like shared room, they actually have cots under the bed that they pull out and the family members just sleep next to the patient and help them.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, the hospital has to have all the services you would find like in a small neighborhood for those people. And I think the pajamas are to keep patients from like going into coffee shops and stuff and getting food they're not supposed to have. Because it's pretty clear who the patients are, because they're roaming around amongst all the non-patients, but they're definitely in those pajamas.
That's interesting. That is pretty interesting.
So yeah, no, this hospital, I've been into the big hospitals in Bangkok that are for like health tourism.
Yeah.
And like Bumrungrad Grad Hospital, that the check-in area has like multiple check-in areas for different languages. You have a Starbucks in the middle, free Wi-Fi,
and they guarantee you see a doctor within like 15 minutes of checking in and some crazy stuff like that.
When you go to these big hospitals in Asia, like I went to a doctor and I was like, I had like a little spot on my leg and I wanted to get it checked to see if it was like skin cancer. And he looked at it and he's like, I really can't tell. He's like, we just need to you need to like maybe do like a biopsy or something. I was like, oh yeah, but I'm on, you know, I'm just traveling. I can't come back. He's like, no. He's like, hold on. He went over to the computer. He's like, in 15 minutes, go to floor 5. So like, and then I was in the next doctor and that doctor was like, yeah, I don't think it's anything to worry about. You just need some, cream. And then he was like, and then I asked him about another problem, completely unrelated. He was like, oh, you know, for that, you really need to go to the orthopedist and ask them. I was like, okay, I'll do that when I go to America. And he was like, no, it's okay, hold on. And then he's like, in 30 minutes, go to floor 7. And that's how it worked. They just kept referring you around until you were finished. So they look on their computer and they can see every single doctor's schedule. And if it's just like a quick consultation, they just book it and you go if the doctors are free. So they can see all of them across the board.
Man, that is definitely not the case here in the United States, as you well know.
You don't leave the hospital. Like, you can spend, if you want to, like my wife calls it like our medical day. So we go to Thailand just for this reason. Our insurance works in Thailand. She will, all the stuff we need, like any kind of health checkup or follow up. I get my blood pressure and everything checked, eyes checked, dental, all of that can be done in the hospital. See, it's really affordable if you have all the doctors in one place and not basically in office buildings that are like homes with a business mortgage. So like, I'm thinking about all those doctor's offices in the Midwest, which are all red brick, and they look like big houses.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, right?
I do. Those, I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Those things like cost money. And I know doctors don't want to be in the hospitals because the hospitals won't give the doctors freedom. So in Asia, it's a little bit different. The doctors practice in the hospitals. So it's definitely more affordable. Anyway, we pick a Tuesday, we book everything in one hospital, and we just go there at like 9 a.m. and we leave at 3, and we've done physicals, eye examinations, dental. If we have any like ongoing or weird issues, we start the process there. So like, if they need us to come back, it's fine. But if they don't, they will write up a preliminary report, make sure it's on file with our insurance company. So when we go back to our home country, we've already done like step one. So, and they can also do the referrals for other hospitals in other countries. Like, they can be like, when they go back to Korea, they need to see a physical therapist. And they'll send that to the insurance company, and the insurance company will pre-approve it so that when we go back to Korea, we don't have to see another doctor. So that's, you know, why my wife calls it like our medical day or like whatever. But when you hear the term medical tourism, that's what it means. And it's a pretty good system. I don't know. If I was in the U.S., I think, and I needed – and I had like a lot of unknowns and I was really frustrated – and I could get like 10 to 2 weeks off of work, 10 days, 2 weeks off, I probably would just go to Thailand. I would buy some – I would see if there's some insurance. A lot of these hospitals have a package you can buy to keep the cost down. I would just go and do it instead of dealing with like these massive copays. Because I think for like, you know, $6,000 to $10,000, you can get quite a bit of treatment in Asia.
I would say like, so, yeah. I read it. Go ahead.
Yeah, high quality. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, it's Asia, it's going to be dirty, like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, these hospitals do treat very poor people, and they also treat very wealthy people all in the same space. And I think they do a pretty decent job at, you know, giving you options. If you have more money, you can pay for like private rooms, and you can get like, I don't know, a lot of people who are on full government support, they might be in a room with three or four people and their families. And their families might actually prepare meals and bring them. There's, you know, obviously different levels, but overall, you get the same doctors, you get the same nurses, and you get the same medicine.
Yeah.
And I think in the end, that's probably what matters.
Agreed. Absolutely. That hospital in Thailand you mentioned, I had a friend who went there he was working in Pakistan. He was an American. He got Hodgkin's, you know, cancer. And he went there for treatment because in Pakistan at the time, they didn't have a hospital that was up to snuff. And he had his own room. He saw the same doctor every day, several times a day, saw the same nurses, knew all the nurses. He said it was great. He said, he said it was just awesome. He said it was just, I mean, he recovered. He's in remission. So, you know, good for him. And that's great. It's not bad. I like it. Do you know what's not so good though, Tony? That doesn't make people so happy?
I know I got really mad typing on my Apple laptop with my IV in. Well, that's what I know.
What Apple laptop are you talking about, Tony? Are you talking about the MacBook Air?
No, unfortunately, I don't really want to say this because it could make some people mad, but let's just say I'm supposed to have a MacBook Air, but I was surprised with a MacBook Pro.
Well, a 13-inch MacBook Pro or the 15-inch? How angry should people be?
I think this is the 13.
Okay. All right. So, you're typing, you have an IV in on a 13-inch MacBook Pro, which a lot of people consider to be a great, not very good, but great laptop. Gripe do you have?
My gripe is that it seems when the MacBook Pro keyboard gets a little bit dirty, it becomes unresponsive.
So your $1,400 computer, $1,400 US computer, gets a little dirty and stops working. Is this correct?
That is correct. And this problem came up with some other teachers recently. So, first, I think we need to back up a bit and talk about the recent recall, the big one.
Yeah, the batteries.
Yes,
I believe it is.
Yeah,
I'm going to find a link for it here.
That is true. It's batteries are swelling.
Yeah, no, it's not there. They're swelling. And so, for people who don't know, this is not a terribly uncommon thing for laptops. And it happens in all brands, not just in Apple. But Apple usually is held to this incredibly high standard, and these things just aren't supposed to happen. They're just not supposed to happen. Here we go. I found a link from the Apple website. I'm putting it in post. I also have a MacBook Pro. Again, I was like you. I was not expecting it. I was expecting to use my Surface Book this year, and they surprised me with a brand new MacBook Pro, 13-inch. I have the Touch Bar,
I have the Touch Bar as well.
And I never use it. Do you ever use it?
Only when I have to turn the volume up. It's super annoying.
You know, and you know what else is annoying is when I launch iTunes, because it's the iTunes play button. Well, anytime you hit play, it launches iTunes, and it's right next to the delete key or the backspace key. And I launch iTunes at least two or three times a day, and I get so angry every time. Tony, I do not love this keyboard at all. And what you're talking about, and maybe it's a coincidence, but I had an issue with the letter M on my keyboard. It was the letter M, and I don't know if it's because it's right where my thumb is, like right by the. But for a little while, the M was not responsive. Like I had to really kind of pound on it, and it only lasted for a couple days, and then it started working fine again. But
yes, it's the same problem. We had this issue. A bunch of teachers started saying like my shift key doesn't work unless I press it really hard, and I'm like, okay, well, I've been working with laptops for a long time. That means there is something under the key.
Yeah.
And they're like, but look, I'm like, you know how I am. I think users are pretty much at fault for everything. So I'm like, just be honest with me. You're not going to get in trouble. How often do you eat over your keyboard? And the guy was like, look, I barely use my laptop, to be honest. And I don't eat at all over my keyboard. And I don't take it home because I don't want my kids to wreck it. So I was like, okay. And then this other girl, same thing, asked her the same questions, same answers. And then we have a little Apple technician guy now. And I was like, tell him to pop the keyboard off or the key off and clean it. And he did. And it worked. So I'm assuming it's like, I don't know why. Maybe it's because these keys, they've switched to like less mechanical keys and they've got those LEDs in them for the keyboard light up. I don't know. Maybe that's doing it. I don't know what's causing it.
Yeah. I don't enjoy typing on it. I understand the reasoning behind it, right? Because there's not a much travel time. So when we're talking about travel time, people, we're talking about how far, like the actual distance the key has to go down. And on the MacBook Pros, the travel time, the travel distance is very, very, very short compared to just about most other keyboards.
But check this out. See if you can hear this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's so loud.
It's so loud.
Which doesn't make any sense if the travel distance is so short. It's so loud. And if you, like, when school started and we had orientation and people were taking notes, there was like 50 people typing at once. I was like, what is that sound? And then I noticed it was all of them typing. I'm like, I have never heard anything like this.
Yeah.
These laptops are so loud that they're distracting to take notes with.
Or if you're in a meeting and you want to take notes on the meeting or you know, somebody says, oh, hey, how about this situation? And you're like, oh, wow, I have something to add on that. Let me send an email to some people. And you send an email, right? Everybody can hear you type the email. It's so unnerving. It's so loud. I hate it. I really do not like the keyboard at all. At all. I love the MacBook Air keyboard. I love that keyboard a lot. It's probably my favorite. But
yep.
But this
the
one.
The MacBook Air is a solid computer. I don't know why. You can still buy MacBook Airs too, as far as I know.
They just don't update them.
Who cares? They work great. Like they're just good. Like they'll be good for the next 2 or 3 years. I don't know. I don't get it.
And the battery life on the MacBook Pro is a far cry from the battery life of the MacBook Air.
If you're someone who travels a lot, you could charge a MacBook Air, get on an airplane. You don't use the Wi-Fi in the airplane usually. Go about 50% on your screen, and that thing would last like 8 to 12 hours. Easy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A whole flight, like a huge international flight. You could watch movies, work. Like I've booked business class before from the U.S. to Asia and with a MacBook Air and worked the entire time, like without having to charge it. I just charged my like phone the whole time.
Yeah,
it's great. USB port, USB.
USB A. This USB C stuff is for the birds. I understand it's going to get there, and I think it's a great idea. You have one port if you want to connect a display. Boom. You want to charge it. Boom. You want to plug in an external hard drive. Boom. All these things you can do with it. That's great. But we're not there yet. Displays. There are very few displays that will take a USB C. There are very few chargers you can buy out there that are USB-C compatible. There are very few hard drives and USB drives that are USB compatible. And there are very few devices, like my Zoom, for example, that will plug into a USB. I got a long list of things that I don't like about it. I got my Surface Book at home, and that's kind of what I use at home.
So what everybody needs to know is this. If you have a MacBook Pro that you purchased in the last, like, year or two,
yep.
Go to Apple's website. There's a spot where you enter your serial number. Your serial number is available.
Oh, thanks, Emma. My daughter just brought me a Valentine's Day card that we gave her. Oh, great. That's awesome. Go ahead, Tony. Sorry. Yeah.
What you do is get on your Apple, go to the upper left screen, click the Apple, click About This Mac.
Yep.
You'll see your serial number. Copy that, paste it into the Apple website and search it, and it will tell you if you need a recall.
Yeah.
If you need a recall, you need to do it.
ASAP. Someone told me that
someone was like, but my battery's fine. I'm like, you don't understand how this works. You put your laptop down. You plug it into charge. You come out in the morning and it's swollen and it's exploded on the inside. Like it's not like your battery's going bad. The thing is going to swell. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's not one battery. I don't think it's probably like most Macs. When you open them up, they have battery packs in them. Usually like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 little battery packs.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not one battery, and one of them can swell in the center and then it'll blow through the keyboard or out the back. It doesn't make a sound. It just swells up and you can't use your laptop anymore.
Yeah, it just stops working.
Yeah, and batteries are toxic. So if your Apple comes up as needing to be fixed, this is the only time you can do it. Because, see, after a recall, none of this is under warranty anymore.
That's right. And for people out there, we put the link to the Apple website, which is Apple's actual website, where you can type in your serial number and see if it needs to be recalled or not.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good.
All right. Sorry, here I got distracted by my daughter. She's recollecting cards. So we're good now. Okay. So anyway, Tony, I wrote a series of posts all this week, 5 posts this week, about how our school is doing like an Olympics. And when I say Olympics, it's like a track and field day. You know what I'm talking about? A bunch of different students are grouped into teams, and all the teams do an event. And based on the event, we all score. You know, they do the events individually. They're not going head-to-head against anybody. Based on how they do on that event, we score them. And last year, this was before I was there, they did it, and it was a big success. They loved it, but the problem was when they were scoring, they were doing all the scoring by hand, and then there was just this big downtime, like 45 minutes of downtime while they were sitting there, you know, with a calculator, people with the calculator scoring different events and trying to figure out who won. So the PE department, which puts this on, they came to the IT department and they said, hey, can you guys make an automated scoring system? And I said, yes, I can do this. And using Google Forms and Google Sheets, I have done just that. And it is, it's not perfect, but it's pretty, I like to say, I'm pretty proud of it. I know it can be a lot better. So for people out there who read those posts, please put your ideas in the comments. But what I did is I made a Google form and for just the recording of the events, right? So you can say they're doing like the water bucket relay. So you click water bucket relay, and then it takes you to the water bucket relay question where it says, you know, what team is this? So you pick the team. And then it's a relay, so it's all about minutes and seconds and how many minutes and how many seconds. And as they put it, that stuff gets fed into a sheet, and then using things like VLOOKUP and query functions, I was able to tie 32 sheets all together.
Wow.
Yeah, it's sweet. And I wrote a post about how you out there can do it. And it's a little technical, and if you've never done anything with spreadsheet, it might be overwhelming, but I put my email in there. Please email me if you have any help. But it got me thinking. What I a person said, wow, Patrick, you made a little program. You wrote a little program with a spreadsheet. And, you know, I was like, yeah, I guess I kind of did. And so it got me thinking, there's this big push for coding, but not everybody's going to use coding. But the chances are people are going to encounter spreadsheets in their life. Maybe we should have more of a focus on spreadsheets instead of coding.
Yeah, I think a lot of good computer science programs start with spreadsheets, especially in middle school. Even now, like, I've got all my middle school kids, we did Scratch, and then we started working with spreadsheets.
Yeah, I mean, it's very practical, and
they don't like it as much, but it's definitely more useful because they can use it immediately in science and in math.
Yeah. And it can be leveraged to such a degree. Like, I know very little about Excel. And just going to any Excel forum, I find this out immediately. Like, wow, I know nothing. But these people can do incredible things with Excel, incredibly complex, like almost building databases with just Excel. And you're building something from nothing, pretty much, like in coding, but you don't have to worry so much about the syntax, and you have a larger pool of people that you can draw from. I think working on spreadsheets and working from Excel and Google Sheets are very similar. So, like, VLOOKUP on Google Sheets is the same as VLOOKUP on Excel.
Yeah. I think they're really good to work with. Here are some things that I think people do need to know. One, unlike a database, spreadsheets of all kinds, even Excel, they have a limit to the number of rows you can have. So, like, if you use it as a database to look things up or store information, that's totally fine. But you have to remember that it's not unlimited. And so I think Google Sheets might be 1,000 or to 5,000 mm-hmm. rows. And I can't remember what Excel is, but they do have a limit. Also, if you're using Excel, it is in a file. It's not in the cloud. So that means that if that file is damaged and you don't have a backup, like usually a backup within like per hour and a bunch of people are sharing it, then you lose a ton of data. So actually, if you can do it in Google Sheets and you want to do something where people are scoring or using it as a database, it's better because there's very few chances for your like cloud to be corrupted. And usually there's a backup you could pull from Google, like if you requested it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then finally, Office 365 schools, SharePoint, which a lot of you don't use, basically uses spreadsheets. They don't look like spreadsheets. They call them lists. But if you can use Excel, you can build stuff in SharePoint. That's how kind of SharePoint was designed, I think. I think they realized they had a lot of Excel people and they wanted to give them a web interface to build databases and stuff. So if you're good with Excel, you can make really complicated stuff in SharePoint. And that means you can make online interactive forms with workflows using a lot of the same commands that you use in Excel. So just throwing that out there, that it is not that much different. And if you've ever used Excel and put like a form on top of it, so it's like user-friendly for people to put the data in, that's really like what SharePoint is. So I'm just throwing that out there. I see a lot of people shying away from it. It's included with your package.
Yeah.
You're probably paying for it, so consider using it.
And from my understanding, and I don't know SharePoint nearly as well as you do, is that SharePoint is incredibly powerful. Like, it can do a tremendous amount of tasks, not just like basic spreadsheeting stuff. Or, I mean, you can do lots of forms with it, and even more than I would say Google Forms and Google Sheets.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It just got me thinking. I was like, wow, this is so powerful. I built it from scratch with kind of a limited knowledge. You know, why? Maybe this is I think this is just a more approachable way to start coding, you know, to get them into programming and thinking that way. So I just thought about it. It was good. Check it out. It's five posts, but I think they're worth it. In case if you're ever in that situation, I looked online and I found other examples of Google Forms and scoring, and they were either way too simple, just stupid, or they were I found one that was incredibly complicated. It was awesome. It was fantastic, but it was just way too much for what we needed. This guy was having I think it was like a Magic the Gathering or some sort of card tournament, and he had something like 100 people doing the card tournament, and here they could actually score what was happening. It was very impressive, but it was way more than what we needed. So I just made my own and decided to document it. So it was pretty cool. It was pretty darn cool. So check it out. All right. So Tony, have you been following the news of all the teacher strikes here in the United States? Have you been seeing any of that?
I've only been following the news in one state, and that's my own Kentucky, where it's blown up really big. And I have a friend, I'm not going to mention his name, but he actually has a fairly high position in one of the larger school districts. And he's a really innovative guy, really good with budgets. He's done some amazing stuff. He even acquired even if I mention this specifically, you'd be able to figure out who he was. He acquired a major company's like this. There was a big company and they moved to a new office. Okay.
Yeah.
And realized that their old office had this massive warehouse that was already set up for like a manufacturing space. And instead of building a makerspace or STEM lab, he actually bought it like wholesale with all the stuff in it.
Oh, wow.
And it's enough that he said every single student in the district can fit in there and work together. They just need this one facility, and then they just needed busing.
Man, that is sweet.
It's not just sweet. It's a genius move, like all around. Oh. It's much more cost effective than building each school its own space. Anyway.
So, yeah.
Last summer, he reviewed this. He knew this was coming. He reviewed this whole thing with me. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, but after he reviewed it with me, and, you know, I wouldn't say this guy's like liberal or conservative. He's just he's smart and he's good with numbers. And he's like, none of this makes sense. So since I was really informed, it's hard to get informed about some of these state issues. It's really difficult. I have been following only Kentucky because at least when I read it, I understand like all the issues inside and out. But it looks like, and I have another friend who also is in finance, and he told me 2 or 3 years ago, we were talking about U.S. schools and pensions.
Yeah.
And he told me the entire U.S. school state pension design, that because most states follow the same kind of concept. He said it's all going to implode because it can't be sustainable. And his mother's like a retired teacher, and he was giving me an example. He's like, I love my mom, but she shouldn't make this much money after she's not working anymore. It doesn't make any sense. He's like, it sounds like a really good idea, but, you know, there's no way you can keep paying people, especially if they're going to keep living longer.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I've been following, just to sum it up, I've been following only Kentucky in as much detail as possible, but I do realize that there's a crisis going on.
If you're paying attention to this at all, in the news, all you see is teachers don't make enough money to live. Teachers want more money. Not want, teachers need more money. School districts need to pay more money. But Tony, I could be wrong. I don't think I am. But I think there is a lot more to this than just teachers pay. And I think it's a little bit of a trap. I think it's a trap. It's a trap, personally.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
I think what teachers really want is, I think they would be happy with their same amount of pay if their working conditions were better in the public
Correct.
School. And so I think what's going to happen is that they're going to get there's going to be this big outcry, lots of attention. They're going to get their pay raise, and then people are going to turn around, and I'm not talking just politicians. I'm talking the entire community is going to turn around and going, okay, we gave you your pay raise. Now, why aren't our kids doing better on the state test?
And that's the trap you fall into. Like, you can give them as much money as you want, but if you don't have your school scheduled properly, structured properly, if you don't have enough employees, if it's just babysitting, you're not going to get any outcome.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go.
Oh, no, okay.
You go ahead, then I'm gonna talk about a study I read in 2016.
All right, perfect. So I saw this post on the EduBlogger, which is EduBlogs has their own blogging site for teachers to write on, and this is the EduBlogger.com, and it was written by Ronnie Burt, who is a teacher, and he goes, how to increase pay? He goes, no more summers. And so what he's saying is that, so let's say a teacher makes, just for argument's sake, just to make it a nice, round, easy number, let's say they make $3,000 a month, right? And they're paid $36,000 a year. And he goes, well, you know what? You don't, you got those summers, and it's really, you're really only getting paid for that 10 months or 9 months of work, you know, when you factor in winter holiday, spring break. So you got 9 months of work that you're getting paid for. So that's really $3,000 for 9 months. He goes, well, let's kind of expand that to 12 months. Like, let's take that salary and expand it out to 12 months. And during that time, instead of having a summer vacation, we'll have teachers do maybe professional development. Maybe they're doing planning sessions with other teachers. So they're planning out curriculum, making sure curriculum is aligned vertically and horizontally, making common assessments, that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of what he's talking about. And the comments are really good. They don't jump on him. They're not mean or ridiculous. But a lot of what you hear is people are like, they're just fed up with the working conditions in there. They just don't like the working conditions. And so it got me thinking. I was like, I don't think pay is the issue. I think pay is what the media is making the issue, because they're trying to make it tangible for everybody else. I think it's a trap. I think this is not going to go down well for teachers. If you're a teacher, I think you should be very worried about how this comes out. And if somebody just starts throwing money at you, that, I don't know, that may be a district you may want to get out of. So
yeah, I know there are certain parts of the country where living conditions like are going to be a problem. Like, if you're working somewhere like in California and you haven't been getting raises and stuff, and you're in one of these areas where they have very fake and inflated housing prices, and like you've got these people making a couple hundred grand a year who can't afford an apartment, that I think is probably the exception to the rule. But those people, definitely, if you're going to run public schools in those areas, you're going to have to pay them more.
Yeah.
Because they can't live. Or you're going to have to make sure that they are able to purchase property at it in a different way so that they can afford it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to that. The other thing is, when you're looking at a salary, what teachers normally, their pay might be lower, and this goes back to the pension programs, but a lot of money's coming out to go into their pension and to go into maybe union dues or other things. So if you get more money up front, you're going to have less money in the end. That's something else I don't think a lot of people think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's say that you're making like $34,000 a year, and your school and the state is putting money away for a pension that will guarantee that when you retire, you're going to get $24,000 a year, like when you retire until you die.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, no, I want a raise. And they're like, okay, we're going to give you, we're going to give you a 50% raise. I mean, that sounds really good. So they're going to give you like around 15 grand extra a year. So now you're going to make like around $50,000 a year.
Uh-oh.
But that could have reduced your overall pension contribution. And so now they're guaranteeing you only $10,000 or $12,000 a year after you can't work anymore.
Yeah.
So that means on $50,000 a year, you need to maybe save, I don't know, I can run this later, but I would say like $500,000 or $600,000 in a tax efficient way so that you can supplement yourself if you have a long life after you retire.
Yeah.
So that means you've got to save that $15,000 every year. You can't spend. That's the thing. Like,
yeah, it's hard to do.
It is hard to do. So, you know, that being said, I do think cost of living and making sure people can have sustainable jobs if they're working at public schools is a concern. Obviously, private schools, you're on your own.
Yeah.
However, because there are some, it's so hard to know all these issues. I can talk about one like study that I cite on a regular basis at my job to people.
Let's hear it.
Who never want to, they never want to hear this. So there are people around the world who do things like make sure that when a new school is built, that school has a financial plan so that they can operate and get their money back and like cover their loans and everything for building the school. And these people have to do a lot of research, especially on staff and hiring staff, making contracts, international teachers versus local teachers. Keep in mind that we talk about international schools, but there are international schools in the United States.
There are.
And they
have one in Indianapolis, folks.
Local hire teachers in the U.S. are local. And these international schools might bring in people from France or other countries to teach language. And those people are on international packages. That means they have extra benefits.
That's correct.
So anyway, this organization, I'm not going to name them, but they're big. And they collected data on, I don't know, around 150 private schools around the world. And this is what they found out. They found out that, number one, the top three reasons people take a job the first time, in the top three, money will be one of the reasons. Not always number one, but it's in the top three. So that means when I'm looking to move to a new job or I'm going to start a job at a school, I'm going to look at the money. It's important. It's in the top three. But when I re-sign my contract, money drops down to around the fifth position and sometimes down to the 10th position. So money starts being less important the longer I stay if I'm a teacher, because teachers generally want to invest in the school and in the community. They want professional development. They want more working time. They want to start special programs. They want to work with smaller groups of students and develop things or help those kids. They want materials. They want things in their classroom. They want to bring in guest authors. They want field trips. They want to do all these things that are not monotonous classroom activities. They also want good benefits more than they want money. For example, if they work at a good school, they want to make sure their kids can go to that school. If they get health care, they want their health care to be as good as it can possibly be, even if that might mean not making extra money on their next contract. And a lot of them want like more holidays or more flexibility in their holidays. So I think looking at just that research, and the people doing this research are doing it because it's their job. Like, they want to help schools do better. They're getting paid to set these plans up. So if their plans don't work, these guys wouldn't have any money. So that's why I trust the study. It's not political. The study is literally based around how can we make more money helping schools. So because it's got that kind of capitalistic, selfish nature, I trust it.
Yeah.
Anyway, other things they say that I found really interesting, and I brought this up at my school in China, and like, you know, I was kind of laughed out of the room, but I think if you look at the result of what happened, I think that these guys are right. You should always pay people as much as you can afford to pay them initially. So they looked at the median income because they were like, look, if you think this person is a good employee, this is the median income for people who do their job. Don't pay them the top salary. Don't pay them the lowest salary. Pay them something fair and tell them that for the entire contract, this is your salary. There's no annual cost of living increase. The only time you can like get more money is if you renegotiate your contract when your contract is up. And the reason they did that was to make it easier for the school to predict how much money they were going to have annually. And they also said that teachers appreciated it because it was very fair. And the teacher could budget. The teacher knew for the next 3 years or 5 years, I'm on this contract. This is all the money I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. Like right now, you know, at this time of year, if you're waiting for a new contract or you're looking for a job, you're going to be really obsessed with like negotiating. But if you knew that until it was time to like re-sign a contract that you weren't going to get any more money, and when you did re-sign your contract, all you were going to get is the median income for your next level up. Like if you're like a step five and you're going to move to a step seven, you actually could figure out what your money's going to be. You're not really negotiating because your school's using a scale that they fixed.
That's right.
So, yeah. And I would say this is not normal. Like this is like an education-centric thing. Teachers don't necessarily want to be business people. They don't want to go through all of this finance stuff. They just want a fair deal. And I believe teachers like their holidays. I think this summer working thing is not smart.
No, I don't think it's smart either. And I think you hit on it. Teachers want they just want a fair deal, but they also want, you know, their job to be fair as well. Right out of college, I knew a teacher who worked in the inner city of Memphis, and she went for a year, and then she's like, I'm done with this. I'm done. I'm either going to switch jobs, or I'm going to go find another teaching job at a private school. And that's what she did. She found a job at a Catholic school, went from $35,000, because that's what they were paying back in 1999, teachers right out of college in Memphis City Schools, down to like $22,000 at a private Catholic school. But you know what? She was happier. She goes, to me, this is more rewarding. She goes, so what I do to offset the cost is I tutor, I coach, you know, I do things to, but you know, I go home happy. I come to work and I'm energized and eager to do what I'm doing. And I feel like I've got resources to work with. And I think
it makes a big deal.
It makes a huge deal. Yeah. And so when I hear all these news stories about, you know, I get worried that America in general is focusing on the wrong thing.
Yeah, I'm not one of these people who think 10 years is a good idea. I don't. And I was looking at some salary scales yesterday for universities because I was trying to see, like with my job, what the salary difference is between working at a university and working at like a big private school. And you know, it's actually not that unreasonably different because it depends on the size of the university and the number of students. Cause I do like a lot of non-educational stuff like in IT. Obviously if you have certain certifications and stuff, you get more money, totally fair. I was looking at some of the professors. So I was looking at a school in Minnesota because if people want to figure out how I do this, I kind of exploit anyone who puts files on the internet that are not secure. So I just I do these huge searches and I find like Excel sheets, full Excel financial sheets that are just publicly available. Maybe they're supposed to be. And I download them or I download their PDF summaries. Or I go to the IRS and look up their 401c3s and see how much they're paying people. So that's how I do it. I'm not hacking or anything. It's all actually on their website. It's just unsecured. Maybe it's supposed to be. Anyway, I found some. So it's like assistant professor. That means non-tenure.
Yep.
Or university. It's not even that big. Like it's a University of Minnesota like campus, but not in the main city. It's in another town.
Yeah.
So the assistant professors are making like $34,000 or $50,000 a year. Tenured professor is kicking in at like $140,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Up to like $300,000. And I'm like, okay, if they're doing research, they're writing stuff, they're inventing stuff, they're helping you get patents.
And grants, whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
But paying a humanities teacher, a professor, to teach like one class a month and you've got to hire like four TAs that you're paying 30 to 50 grand a year to support them, who is like writing some kind of like research that doesn't produce any intellectual property or any cash flow for the university. I'm not saying it's useless. I'm just saying it's not producing it. And all their research is going into journals, which aren't available to anyone to read unless they subscribe and pay to them.
That's right.
That whole thing, that just doesn't make any sense to me. And you're paying them like $140,000 to $300,000 a year for life until they retire, regardless of their performance.
That's right.
That's why I like tenure. I don't care that the guy or the lady or whoever has made that like life choice and done really well and made money. But what if they stop working? Basically, if they don't break the law, you have to just keep paying them. And they can take sabbaticals. You have to keep paying them.
Yep.
And again, if they're producing stuff that you need, that you find valuable, great. But when they stop producing it and you can't get rid of them, then it just seems really unfair. It seems like what you're creating is a culture of like low-end slave labor, and whoever can survive and last the longest gets the next job. I feel like a lot of public schools and districts must have similar problems.
Yeah, because you have, as long as they're just showing up, and I've seen these teachers, and they're just burned out. Like, they've got very little left to give. Like, they've given everything they can, and I feel for them. And they're in their 29th year, and they're like, I'm just hanging on. I got to go for another year or another 6 years. I can do it, but it's not going to be pretty. You know, I feel for them, but at the same time, a good friend of my family, she is a teacher and taught in a really rough school her entire career, one school her entire career, lots of poverty. And she's like, she goes, I don't miss teaching one day. I don't miss it one day. She goes, teaching is for the young. And I think there's something there. I think there's something, something for that.
I would say that's true unless you're like, hello?
Yeah, there you are. You ducked out for a second.
I would say that's true unless you're in an environment that keeps you energized. I work with plenty of people and have for many years that are much older than me, and when they're happy in their jobs, they seem to be doing well. When they are running around doing a bunch of bureaucratic stuff, having to stay late, go to meetings that don't seem to have anything to do with their job,
it does
wear them down. I don't think that everybody should get out of teaching when they're young. In fact, I think it would be good if some people worked for 20 years and then went into teaching. Those types of people are great for high school students to especially to work with. But, you know, the whole process, again, is like they want people for life. They incentivize that. They take away the incentives. They put the incentives back. It's completely unstable. So, you know, the way it's set up, your first few years, like first 10 years are horrible.
Yeah,
decade of your life and do a horrible job to get anything going, to get moving. And I think that whole model is horrible. That's why I think private schools and international schools, I've seen public school teachers go into international schools that you and I would be like, man, this school's crazy. I couldn't work here.
Yeah.
And they're coming out of public school and they're like, this place is great.
Like, oh yeah. Yeah.
Stay here for like 10 years before I even realize it's bad.
Yeah. And the school I'm at now, it's a great school. There's no question about it. And if you look at our teacher salaries and you compare them to the public school salaries, I think they're in the same ballpark, but they're definitely lower. But I'm just like, man, but there's so much more, gosh, they get so much more freedom with the curriculum. The kids and the parents that they work with are awesome. The people they work with are energized and dedicated. I was like, you can't put a price tag on that. Like, I bet we could pay them even less. We're not going to do this because but I bet we could probably pay them even less. And I bet they would be like, man, this is pretty darn good. I'm sticking around. you know, for a lot of people.
I don't know if you can pay him less. You might be able to skip a couple raises, but I don't think you can pay him less, okay. Patrick.
All right. Well, maybe not paying him less, but yeah, maybe skipping a couple raises. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Good topic. I just want to summarize Patrick's main point. Whenever you take money as a solution, there's a trade-off somewhere.
Yeah.
And you got to be careful with that. Like, you got to really be careful with that. So even if you're in an international school, if your school's like, oh, we're giving everybody a raise, you've got to ask all the questions. What does this mean for healthcare? Well, we're giving everybody a raise, but we're going to negotiate the healthcare package in the summer after we've given everybody a raise. No. If you're overseas, especially, or you're living in the U.S. in like a remote location, you make sure your school has some pressure to negotiate healthcare first.
Yeah.
And healthcare packages for overseas, that's where your evacuation insurance comes from too.
That's right.
So you got to keep that in mind. Usually it's all wrapped up. Next, after school activities. What does that mean? Well, it means that your job could go till 6 or 7 o'clock at night. If your school gives you a raise, but cuts out the money they use to pay other people to deliver after school activities.
Yeah.
Or they might just demand more of you for no reason, even if there's no demand for after school activities.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was going to give another scenario, but go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Well, here's an example. Maybe you teach a specialty subject like IT or PE. Maybe you're like, we're giving everybody a raise. Oh, but we got rid of an art teacher and a technology teacher and a PE teacher at every level. So now your classes are going to go from 20 to 27. Instead of teaching 120 students a semester, now you got to teach the entire middle school. So you're going to have like 200, 250, you know, maybe you'll see a different class every day. But I mean, that's a tough situation to walk into.
Here's some very rough math. And I hope like there's no one listening that actually cares about what I'm going to say, because they're going to get really upset and like attack me. Here's some rough math to know if your raise is like legitimate and you don't need to worry. If you believe average cost of living goes up 3 to 4%, if you get a 5% raise, that means that they would have needed to raise tuition as well, probably around 8%. So that would cover your raise plus the percentage increase that the school's going to face when inflation goes up. So the school would take 3% for itself to offset inflation and give you 5% more money. If they don't raise tuition and they're giving you a raise, that money is coming from somewhere. And schools do have endowments, and they could technically use money that they've got banked to pay salaries, but that's usually for an emergency. When like lose a bunch of students for some reason,
or major capital funds, like we have to renovate the gym because the ceiling is falling in.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that, like, you know, if they raise tuition, subtract 3 to 4% from it, your raise can't be more than that number, or they're taking money from somewhere.
Yep. And if they're taking money somewhere, that usually is going to come back and get you in one way or another. So,
and if your school's like, oh, we're giving you a raise because we decided to put 70% of X budget into like mutual funds, and we're going to pay you with the earnings. You need to really be concerned about that, because that's not going to last forever.
That's right.
You definitely want that stuff banked on your behalf as it grows, not paid out. As far as I know, maybe it's better tax-wise, but I can't really see a scenario where your salary is going to be stable if it's based on an investment.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed. Anyway, well, I'm glad I brought that up. I'm glad I put that on the old agenda there.
Take a pay cut, get paid in gold bars. That's all I'm going to say.
I say platinum.
Give me platinum. I will work for less money, but I want it paid in precious metals.
Not diamonds. Chinese people are growing them. Anyhow, That was random out of nowhere. Anyway, I think that's good. I for our last topic, maybe we'll save it for the next show. It wasn't a big topic. It was kind of a fun topic to talk about, but it's not a big thing. But anyway, I think we've done a great show. Hope you've enjoyed it. For IT Babble, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Tony.
And catch us on the next episode and keep on babbling out there. You can find us on www.itbabble.com. Out.